Hi. Today I want to talk about how to do this stuff in the local church. I mean, we've been talking all quarter now about abuse of various kinds, and I just want to zero in on asking what can you do in a local church to make it a safe place for people who are struggling with abuse issues? What can you do to make it a helpful place? I do think the goal is to make it both of those, both safe and helpful. And it's not an easy task, I think, if you ask, starting from the typical congregation. There's a lot of hard work that would need to be done to make that happen, but it's possible. It can be done. And so today I'm just going to go through briefly a list of possibilities, you know, things that you might do, starting from what seemed to me pretty easy and straightforward things to help shape the climate and prepare it for larger scale things later, because this is not going to happen all at once. Abuse tends to be, as we said at the very beginning lecture, the very first lecture, tends to be the kind of thing that people look at and then sometime later notice that they haven't looked at it. And so we have to come back to it. And I think both as individuals and as institutions, there's that dynamic of it being very difficult to sustain a focus for a long period of time. So how do we sort of hardwire some attentiveness to abuse into the DNA of a local congregation so that it just is part of who we are? Maybe it's not the main, you know, maybe it doesn't show up in the mission statement as sort of the big top level who we are, but it's part of our DNA to be about this, to care about this, to be a place where it's safe to talk about this and where there's resources for dealing with this. That's what I'm focused at. All right, just a few really, what seemed to me like pretty easy things that I would do probably day one, if I were a pastor of a local church. I suspect I may now be unemployable in the local church, I don't know. But these are some of the things that I would try to do right away. You know, I think I told a story earlier in the class about changing the greeting at the beginning of a worship service. I cannot remember whether I've told that story so many times, I can't remember what I told in this class, but this is a story about the pastor who couldn't think of anything he could change in his church, to change the greeting one time to sound something like, I learned at a Fuller workshop this weekend that if you've experienced abuse as a kid, sometimes it's hard to trust churches later in life to be a safe place. And if it took you some courage to get here this morning, I want to thank you for coming. Let's sing hymn number 142. And he didn't think anybody heard that because people are typically still talking when he does the greeting. They're out in the foyer, don't come in until the organ starts for the first hymn. Didn't think anybody'd notice. And a year later, he's got a support group for survivors of childhood sexual abuse with a therapist to coach the leadership team. And this provides the incentive and the sort of focus that starts to impact a number of other ministries in the congregation. So just changing something small, this is, I suppose, the butterfly effect in the local congregation. See what happens when you change something that you think doesn't change anything. And you might see a lot of change come from it. Second example like that is doing something on Mother's Day and Father's Day. Many years ago, my wife and I decided that was those were just a couple of days in the year when we were not well enough to go to church, because we knew what it would be. It would be this sort of relentlessly cheerful Hallmark card version of reality about how wonderful moms are, how wonderful dads are. And if there's an enormous amount of cognitive dissonance between that sort of idealized experience of parents and your own personal experience of parents, it can be really crazy making. And it's not that hard to say on Mother's Day, for example, that I know that a lot of you, like me, came from families where we just didn't get the kind of parenting that we needed. Some of us were hurt in our families. Some of us were very seriously hurt in our families. And we're not here to celebrate that. We're here to celebrate the fact that in God's family, we have a Father who loves us like crazy. That's what we're really here to celebrate. And that God's intentions for parenting for all of us is for our well-being and to nurture us and grow us and to help us become everything that we can be. So, I mean, I don't think it's hard to hard to say that. It just depends on the congregation. It depends on you and how much whether you've done enough. You might have to do some preparations even to do that kind of thing on Mother's Day, because you might get some resistance to that kind of thing. Somebody might say, I really missed the Hallmark card version. And that sort of a resistance, how you use that is really important. I mean, that's sort of pushing, it means you're pushing a little bit, but you're pushing in the right direction. And so you don't back off because you meet resistance. You sort of welcome the resistance, receive it in. The people who resist the most to small changes in the right direction may sometimes turn out to be your strongest allies over the long haul. But you have to honor their resistance, pay attention to it, find ways to lovingly respond and engage and all those kinds of basic pastoral skills. A third thing that I think is relatively easy has to do with policies and procedures for situations involving abuse. You don't even have to have an actual situation of abuse at hand before you do policies and procedures. In fact, it's far better to do policies and procedures ahead of time. There's some links on the website to some sample policies. They're at least starting points for things. But I would be doing with the leadership team probably kind of case study kinds of things to help people think through policies. Mary comes home from junior high camp and says her counselor put her hand down to my pants. Well, if you're trying to figure out policies and procedures, when you get the phone call about that in your office, your capacity to be clear will be impaired because you'll be traumatized too. And so it's very disorienting and confusing, and you're trying to figure out what to do. And if you have a policy written out ahead of time, it says, these are the people you need to call first. Don't forget the church's insurance broker, the police, county social services. Who are you going to call, and in what order and why, and who are the key people in the congregation that you want to bring together to craft the specifics of your policy? How are you going to deal with the press if that's part of it? All this stuff is just a whale of a lot easier to figure out when you're not actually in the midst of a crisis. So develop some kind of policies and procedures. You can't anticipate everything, but if you pick two or three different kind of traumas, you may come up with a policies manual of some kind that'll help you enormously when it really comes down to actually having to do something. I would, again, think it's one of the easiest things to do is to start to identify community resources. If I would be doing this week one, I mean, it would be church bulletin would every week have the phone number for the local contact phone number for AA and Narcotics Anonymous and Sexaholics Anonymous. It would just be there, and the local phone number for the local domestic violence counseling center. That would just be those resources would always be present as part of the paper that anyone gets who walks into this church. It sends a very important message. It's a message, we need to hear this, or we interact with people who need to be aware of these resources, so we're just always talking about and always making them available to people. Now, there's lots of ways to give visibility to those resources. A church bulletin is an obvious kind of no-brainer one. That in just a small way, again, helps to shape the identity of the congregation. We're the kind of people who need to sometimes take advantage of resources like this. But there's other ways to give visibility. I would probably be doing once a month, once every other month, having somebody from the community into the church and saying, so I can stand up during the announcement time and say, I've been having lunch with Joe a couple times recently. He's the executive director of the domestic violence shelter here in town, and I'm very impressed by the work they do. I think as a congregation, they're doing the kind of things we're really grateful that someone in the community is doing that. And I asked him to come this morning so we could just thank him for doing what he does. Let's give a round of applause for him. And, you know, the phone number for the organization is in the bulletin, and there's some papers at the back of the congregation if you want to learn more about what they do. If you want to become a volunteer down there, they always have needs of various kinds. If you want to become a donor to that work, they're doing good work in our community, and we're grateful for them. It doesn't mean you're going to, you know, let him preach on Sunday or necessarily even stand up in front, but it's a way of pronouncing blessing on people doing things in the community in the area of abuse recovery. And the more of that kind of thing you can do, the stronger message it sends to the congregation that we're paying attention to this. We care about this. And that, again, has impact in many ways that you can't always anticipate ahead of time, both in terms of the kinds of resistance that emerge and the kind of opportunities for really doing ministry in this area that will emerge. Next, I suggest a pretty rigorous examination at actually every aspect of the worship service, but I've listed here in particular focusing on hymnology. I think what you'll find is that there are many hymns that in the current cultural context just feel quite misogynist. They assume that male pronoun includes everybody. Which may be a technical truth, but there's going to be a certain percent of the population who finds it difficult to connect with things because we speak in that way and make assumptions about the congregation because we have not attended to deleting misogynist language from things like hymns. And even more importantly, there are quite a number of hymns, I think, that ask the congregation to tell God in a hymn, in a worship service, in a sacred place, that they are feeling things that they may not be feeling. So if you're singing a hymn that's about how happy you are, you're asking the congregation to express a particular affect. And everybody in the congregation who's not experiencing that affect, maybe they've had a horrible week, maybe they're having intrusive memories, and they're disorganized and confused, and I'm supposed to now come and sit in the worship service and sing to God about how happy I am to be a Christian. I'm a mess being a Christian. I'm struggling being a Christian. I can't seem to make it work. And now I'm supposed to say that I'm happy. Don't ask people to say things that for a substantial percentage of the congregation are just not true. I think that's a real basic entry-level expectation of hymnology. Don't ask people to sing things that aren't true for a substantial portion of the congregation. Now, I know the counter-argument is that these are hymns that are aspirational in character in terms of the affect that's expressed. As if there is an applied, we wish we were the kind of people who were happy all day long. But I don't give much credibility to that line of reasoning. It's still asking people to say something that's not true. Hymns, in my view, and this is a whole other topic, another class really, should really be about God, not about what I'm feeling this morning, and particularly not about sort of transient affects. I might have some access to being happy about being a Christian, but to assume that is what's dangerous as a community. Because if we assume and collectively act as if we're just a happy all the time kind of group of people, the people for whom that is not true are going to say, "I don't belong here. This isn't about me. This isn't for me." So we're sending to the population of people who are probably at highest risk this message of, yeah, maybe if you can't sing what we, I mean, it doesn't bother us to sing this stuff. So maybe there is something wrong with you. I don't think that's the kind of message we want to send, but again, take a look at hymns and see if there's anything there that strikes you. Lastly, and stuff that I think is sort of legal and can be done really early on is about legal obligations. Depending on your church structure, this may already be done. It's kind of a no-brainer. Your church needs to know the staff and the whole volunteer corps in a congregation needs to have some sensibility about legal reporting requirements, and that tends to be covered in the introduction to pastoral counseling, so I'm not sure I'm going to spend too much time today on it. But on the website, there are links to state-specific requirements for reporting. In I think all states, pastors are mandated reporters if there is a suspicion of child abuse. So at least for that one kind of abuse, there are legal obligations. Well, many other kinds of abuse where there is no legal obligation, although it's my custom to report things when I think the act of reporting might be helpful in the process, even if there's no legal obligation to do so. So I would encourage you to take legal obligations to report as sort of a just the beginning. It's not, you know, have we met that bar? Because even stuff that doesn't meet that bar may be prudent to report under certain circumstances. Okay, how about stuff that ups the ante a little bit? You're not just making lists of resources, but you're getting a little bit more engaged in networking in the community or with other people who are at least talking about abuse as an issue. Building relationships with local resources. It's hard to make generalizations about this, but I tend to put a pretty high priority on this. I'm taking people out to lunch and getting to know them, asking them about what they do, making sure I understand their policies and procedures. This is both nonprofits in the area, county social services. Don't make your first phone call to county social services be about an active case of abuse. Call someone there, educate yourself about their internal process and what they do and how they handle things before you have a problem like that. Maybe they have an educational process for pastors new to the community. Maybe you can take one of them out to lunch and just grill them about it. What is this like? How does this work? What kind of problems do you run into? What things should I be watching for? What sort of problems do you think I should be watching for in my community? So being proactive about building a resource network, both with government workers and private sector workers, I just think is a pretty high priority. That'll pay off big time over the long haul. Same as applies to people, either counselors in the community. You need to have some sense of who's out there, what they do. Most therapists will be happy to chat with you briefly because they think you're a potential referral source. And you know, you again, this is a little bit more work involved, sort of screening potential counselors for the congregation and knowing when a particular person is a good fit for different circumstances. It takes more than just a casual meeting with someone to sort that out. The process of identifying the allies, and I think of this both in terms of local congregational dynamics, but also within denomination or other networks, clergy networks in the community. You find out what's going on. There may be people who are already doing really good jobs of identifying all the resources in the area, and I'll be happy just to share that information with you. It could save you a lot of time. So instead of starting from scratch, always find. Always have your antenna out about other people who are doing something, anything in this area that might represent resources that you can take advantage of in later stages of things here. Third thing is a little bit more work besides just sort of welcoming people to church has to do with forming a committee, kind of a coordinating committee for a response to abuse. It could be an even bigger mandate than that, coordinating committee for addiction, abuse, and trauma. But some of you are going to wind up working in congregations where forming committees is how you get things done. I'm sorry, but That's true. Others are you are going to be working in congregations where that is not how you get things done. But if you are working in a church where forming a committee is how you get things done, then you need to form a committee because that's how you get things done. And it may not match your instincts about what you would like to do, but it is the sort of the necessary structural elements of things actually eventually getting into the DNA of the church. It's got to go through that and that kind of process. So don't neglect those kind of obvious things. There's a lot of advantages to having a coordinating committee. Over the long haul, you're sitting there in your office and someone asks to see you and they come in, you have an appointment and you hear their initial story about domestic violence and you say, thank you so much for telling me your story. It's a very painful narrative. I just want you to know that as a congregation, we're trying to get ourselves prepared for responding in healthy ways to people who are struggling with the kinds of things you're struggling with. And we have a committee of people who is really on top of these kinds of issues and knows all the resources in town. I'd really like you to meet with Mary, who's the head of that committee, because she has helped lots of people in your kinds of situations to find just the right resources. She's much more educated than I am about the particular skill sets of different therapists in town and things like that, and resources when therapy is too expensive and you can't find the right kind of thing. So. One of the things I want to make sure we do is set up a meeting for you with Mary. So, I mean, wouldn't that feel like you had something of substance to offer to somebody? I mean, it's also shapes the identity of the congregation. We are prepared for this kind of problem. We're not shocked by this kind of problem and distance ourselves because it feels dangerous. This is just part of normal for us because we even have a committee that's attentive to this and knows how to find, has recruited, in the case of domestic violence, say, there are a few people in the congregation that will give, overnight stays in their extra bedroom if there's not a room available in the shelter. Things like that you would eventually develop as a congregational resource. I think that would mean a lot to someone struggling with these issues, that sense that these people have anticipated this kind of problem. It would mean a lot. It sends a very powerful message. So now stuff that's even a little bit more work. Sort of education and prevention requires both some attention to economics and to human resources. But there's a lot of education and prevention kinds of things that can be done. I would make it non-negotiable that there'd be something about violence prevention as part of premarital counseling. You might get some resistance about that. You have this wonderfully happy couple who are quite deeply in love and everything is happy. They're going to have this wonderful wedding, and you're going to have to say, has either of you ever slapped or hit the other person? It just feels like very awkward, doesn't it? It just feels really awkward to ask that question. But you really need to ask that question, and you need to take the answer pretty seriously. And you need to say somewhere in premarital counseling, even though it's inconceivable to you right now and you can't imagine, I want you to know that we care about you and this marriage. And we know that sometimes marriages hit trouble. And if that ever happens, I want you to know that you can call us. There's no way to anticipate how people will respond to that. It may just feel like it's huge downer kind of thing. Maybe you can do a better job than I could of avoiding that, but it needs to be a part of that process. Because it's so common. And anything you can do ahead of time to flag potential issues there and get people resources early is going to be helpful. I'm also a big fan of having something like a congregation-wide abuse prevention week. And you could throw all the kinds of things that you would usually throw into a week emphasis. You preach on something related to abuse, have someone give a testimony, you have a local therapist or somebody from town gives a lecture on Saturday night that's open to the public about recovery from abuse or some aspect of that. You try to package a whole week. And there are, if you go on the website, you'll see that there are some links to national organizations that sponsor different kinds of abuse prevention week or abuse prevention month. I just can't think of a downside myself to connecting in with a larger effort like that. It says, because we're part of a community that's becoming more aware of this problem, and this is the week of the year that we say that. And it's just one week. It's it's upping the ante a little bit. It's different than changing the greeting one time. It's saying you sort of hardwiring something important into the church calendar. But you have Children's Sunday once a year. You have other kinds of annualized things that just, it's an important part of what we do that gets visibility in the worship service once a year. I don't see a downside to that. I've included here the notion that it'd be good to include abuse prevention in Christian education curricula. I'm quite aware of the fact that if you go to the usual publishers of Christian education curricula and ask, well, what do you have that includes stuff about abuse prevention, they're going to look at you with glassy eyes, like a deer in the headlights kind of look, because they don't have anything. There's very little out there. At least last time I checked, there's very little out there. And there may not be a very, very big market for it. But the question is, if you have kids that are struggling with abuse issues, or they're in homes affected by the addictive process, or the dynamics of abuse, they need special resourcing in Christian education. Maybe you can find life skills education materials or other things like that can, at least lean in that direction. That's worth looking for. But asking how would you optimize a Christian education program so that kids who have experienced abuse can get resourced at an early stage in life is a really, really important agenda. Background checks is another thing it takes. It's not really that much work, sends a powerful message. Again, someone might say, why are you making all these assumptions? Well, you're not making assumptions, you're just doing due diligence and protecting yourself from legal scrutiny if something does go wrong. And, it's not my view that typical background checks will come up with all that. Quite rare that they'll come up with any actionable information. But the process of doing this puts you in compliance with best practices here. Everybody's going to say, everybody who knows about this issue is going to say this is a non-negotiable no-brainer. And it's really irresponsible not to be doing background checks on staff and volunteers and lay leaders. And I think it's a way of, again, sending a message to the whole congregation. We recognize we live in a world that is full of abuse, and we're trying to pay attention. This is just another way we do that. And again, it's that little, it gets the consistency of that message that we're a congregation that cares about abuse and is going to do what it can about abuse that helps shape the identity of the congregation and makes possible to do the next step. Educating lay leadership about the dynamics of abuse is a pretty important agenda. You know, people, this is certainly true for lay counselors and spiritual directors, but also the small group leadership folks. They're really the community mental health workers in our context. They're out at the front line. They're observing families and individuals, and they're often developing red flags about this. I don't know what to do about this, but something feels wrong here. How are you going to resource that person and give them enough information about the dynamics of abuse to help them, do the kind of assessment that's appropriate at their level, and also educate them about the resources that are available if they think there is a serious problem of some kind. You want to have people who are closest to the front lines, well-informed, and feeling well-resourced about these kinds of issues. Bigger stuff, developing support group programs is a bigger agenda. It probably requires staffing to do well, particularly if you're focused on developing support group for kids. Let me say a bit about a ministry that I was actively involved in starting, which is a support group program for abused kids. This is the Confident Kids program, a link on the website, confidentkids.com. This started, I date the foundation as 1 year when I was just getting started, my first job in a local church, and I was starting a series of support groups. We had a very active support group for alcoholics and a pretty active group for spouses of alcoholics. And it became clear to me that the size of the group was constrained by the fact that we didn't provide childcare. So, being the innocent that I was, I went into the office of the Director of Early Childhood Education on staff, and I said, look, we have all these exciting things going on for adults, and I just need you to provide childcare so we can grow. Well, I barely got out of her office alive. I mean, she was livid, and I think quite appropriately so. Thinking, if you, the phrase that I remember is, if you're working with hurting adults, you're working with hurting kids, what are you going to do for these kids? They don't need babysitting, they need something else. And I remember sitting in her office looking at each other and realizing that we really didn't have the slightest idea how to do a program for these kids, and that's really what was leaving us angry and frustrated and not irritable. The sort of what do you do for children who have been abused, that are in the third grade? How do you develop an effective program for them? Well, that led, long story, to the development of the Confident Kids program used in 100 or so churches now, and it's a life skills training program, so it works on very, very simple life skills. I mean, they sound simple, but for people who have been abused, they're difficult skills to learn, but they're, I think of it as all the stuff that I needed when I was 8 that I didn't get, things like it's okay to feel what you feel, and you always have choices. Things like that, really basic sort of skill sets. But it's also taught in a support group setting so that the kids are there to support each other as they struggle with these issues. And it's, all the stuff that kids need. There's activities and making things and projects and stuff. The power of it really, to my mind, the sort of optimal configuration of this resource is, you have, dad goes to his AA meeting and mom's going to Al-Anon and kids are going to Confident Kids and they get in the car on the way home from church and they've all been working on the same stuff. And that's a very powerful intervention in the dynamics of a family where there's addiction, abuse, or trauma. You have resources for everybody at the church. And so I can't recommend that highly enough. I mean, I do need to emphasize this is not like changing the announcement. This is a major commitment of resources, both human resources and financial resources, to pull off something like this. It's very demanding in terms of the leadership team. But it's a very, very powerful intervention. I remember getting a phone call when we did the pilot groups for Confident Kids. The very, very first groups, I got a call from the principal of an elementary school. And the only thing I remember about the call was he said, what did you do for this kid? Because this kid has changed. So there was a change in a kid who was going to Confident Kids that was so substantive that the principal of a local school called me and said, what's going on up there at the church? I don't think that happens very often. But it is certainly the kind of resource that could be profoundly helpful to kids. Now, there's other strategies like that. I'm really fond of Royal Family Kids Camps, which is a strategy for developing summer camp programs for kids in the foster care system, which are almost always kids who have been abused. Anything that you can do for foster care kids is, for all intents and purposes, an abuse, a strategy for working with abused kids. And so look at that link as well. These are all local church-based, both Confident Kids and Royal Family Kids Camp program are local church-based strategies for reaching out to abused kids. And they're very powerful, very effective. They have lots of resources available for helping a congregation reach out effectively to abused kids. Now, the analogous strategy for adults would be to develop some sort of support strategy for adults who have experienced abuse. And there's lots of different ways of going about this. And on the website, I give you a link to the SALTS program, the Open Hearts Ministry, and their offerings, which is there are not many ministries in the Christian community that have developed a national scope. This is one of them. It's still quite shocking to me that the Christian community doesn't have, five different networks of support groups for survivors of sexual abuse. We should have one that's more charismatically focused and one more mainline denominational focused and one evangelical focused. We should have, choices here. But we're just at the beginnings of this, of taking this issue seriously and developing different kinds of resources. Who knows, maybe God will call one of you to develop a resource like that, that it can be scalable so that lots of different people can participate. Anyway, I give you some links there, and then some examples of secular programs, both 12-step models, which has been, to me, fairly surprisingly helpful to a significant proportion of people who are struggling with abuse, in particular if you're dealing both with substance abuse issues and recovery from abuse at the same time. Finding a 12-step resource that really gets how complicated that is a really important resource. So if there are, survivors of incest anonymous groups in your area, you need to know about that, because that's a really helpful resource. And finally, there's lots of models for therapist-led groups. If you can find a way to encourage the developments of resources like that in your area, it's just a huge gift, both to your congregation and to the community to do so. Some other thoughts. There's a whole discipline out there about creating critical incident response teams, and I think it's adaptable for use in a local church context. Just Google critical incident response teams. You'll find training programs, and they're more focused around natural disasters, but also focused on can get sort of strategies that are very adaptable to the crisis response in a local congregation. Things that might take just a huge amount of the pastor's personal energy and time and focus can be moderated by having a team of people that is already in place. A single phone call generates this small group that will take the lead on this. And there's a therapist and a lawyer and a nurse and I don't know what else. You know, you could develop your best resources. You don't call them every week, but if you've got something where you feel like, I'm over my head here, I need a group of people. If you've done your homework ahead of time about that and developed a critical incident response team, you have a huge resource for staying sane over the long haul in ministry. I want to say something about missions because deep down I'm fundamentally a missiologist, I think, just sort of paying attention to who's really there, which is at the root of missiology. Who are we trying to reach with the gospel? Who's available to become members of the kingdom of God? And what you find, if you take that question seriously, is a substantial proportion of those people have experienced abuse of some kind or another. So we ought to sort of be thinking missiologically about this. We should be thinking globally about strategies for helping people who have been abused. This there's lots of opportunities for developing short-term missions projects around this, helping abused kids, children at risk. There's that whole discipline of children at risk that's emerged in the last decade or so. Connect with the VivaNet network around that at least, so you're getting information about different kinds of things that are going on globally. Make sure that the stuff you do at the local church level has that sort of missional feel to it. It's also about participating in this initiative of the global church to be responsive to these kinds of problems. It's also possible that you could take on as a full-time missionary someone to work in this area, either work in nationally in the U.S. or work globally in this area with kids at risk, with adults who have been abused. There's all kinds of ways in which you can meaningfully participate as part of your missions program in abuse ministry. Again, just a reference to a whole discipline that might be a helpful resource, and that's the Restorative Justice Ministries. Because of the frustrating experience people who have been harmed experience in the criminal justice system or the civil justice system, which are not focused on restoring relationship. There is had been the development of different strategies for restorative justice, trying to restore things to the way they were before the harm was done. And there's no way I can cover that in this class, but there's some very exciting initiatives out there, both sort of inside the criminal justice system in the United States and outside of it, to develop programs that mediate between victims and offenders and try to create pathways by which reconciliation can become a possibility, where the person in the process of forgiveness does helpful things for the offender, like rebuke them, and the person in the process of repentance does helpful things to the person in the process of forgiveness by offering to make amends. Those kinds of things which make possible reconciliation become can become very important. Again, Google restorative justice or Bing restorative justice if you're so inclined. But the last possibility, as I've mentioned frequently here, it seems to me that there's likely to be crises in the life of the local church where abuse is just part of the territory. And when that happens, it's important to have enough grounding yourself that you can, I don't like the expression which I have here on the slide, use the crisis, which might have a manipulative feel to it. But there is this occasion, and there are going to be options in how you respond to this that will send a message to the congregation as a whole about who we are as a congregation. And if handled appropriately, you have an occasion here for shaping the identity of the congregation. I think that's my point. Use this as an occasion to say, we can talk about this. We will not hide ourselves from this, no matter how painful it is. We will not let this become another secret that sits silently in the psyche of this congregation for the next 30 years. We will let the light in on this. We will not hide ourselves from it. The capacity to do that will have an impact on how the congregation thinks about itself. And it gets difficult to do that because at the time, there'll be almost always pressures to be silent. We don't talk about these things. It's too shameful. It's too awful. It's going to spoil our reputation in the community. Oddly, it might provide, if you can tell the truth about things, a way to send a message to the entire community that this is a safe place for people who have been hurt, or families that are enmeshed in difficult life problems. Okay, how long have I gone? 45 minutes. I'm going to be really brief then. I have a whole thing I do about preaching about recovery. I'm going to make it really short. You don't have to preach about abuse to be helpful to people who have been abused. That is, you don't have to, in preaching, to be explicit about abuse. You don't have to say, this is the sermon about abuse. You know, if you're preaching about hope, and you have three words in there that someone who's struggling with abuse, that makes it possible for someone who's struggling with abuse to know that, oh yeah, this is about me too, then you're getting done what you need to get done. If you say, you know, hope is difficult for all of us, sustaining hope is difficult for all of us, and we feel like we should be more hopeful than sometimes we're able to be for people who have you know, issues related to abuse in particular, sometimes it's very difficult to stay hopeful about change. It's true for all of us. Okay? That doesn't make it a sermon about abuse. It's just a line that you put in there. And you don't do that every Sunday, but it just becomes part of how you preach. It's a recognition that a third of your audience maybe is experiencing these issues, and you're not going to be silent about them. And there's all kinds of other themes where that same strategy works very well. I've listed some for you here. I've suggested the importance here of reading both the text and the congregation. That is how I understand the fundamental task of preaching, is taking the text seriously and taking the congregation seriously. Make sure you're preaching. Make sure you don't spend the next 10 years preaching to your professors at seminary. Make sure you're preaching to the congregation that actually shows up in church. And I think I wasted a lot of time trying to be rather more impressive to seminary types when I needed to be preaching. I needed to sit on the ground and be with the people in the congregation. Finally, I just wanted to suggest that an important principle, interpretive principle, has to do with paying attention to the affect in the text. This is there's a much larger hermeneutical argument that I would make here if I had time. It has to do with what sort of genre the text is, and I would argue that it is an incredibly affective document, the biblical text. It's full of affect. If you approach it as if it were an encyclopedia of facts, you will miss all this affect. In fact, all the time, I think, I hear sermons that are based on someone who has examined and studied a text before they've experienced the text. It is, I think, as if someone wrote you a short note, and the note says, I love you. And if the first thing you do is parse that verb, I think you'll never really get the message that's being sent. Now, it's important to be able to parse the verb. It might say, I loved you, past tense. Okay, so it's important to be able to parse the verb. But if you go there first, I think you'll miss the central message of the text. So watch for that. People who are in the midst of recovery from abuse are going to be gravitating towards the affective center of a text in any case. So it's just part of going with them where they're going to be going. And I just think that you'll get to different content if you remember that God is not the unmoved mover, but the most moved of all. Okay, we could talk lots more about that. I want to talk about using, not using again, but letting spiritual practices like communion be accessible to people who are struggling with abuse. And I already talked about framing communion as a kind of exercise in competitive memory, that God has a memory here that he's offering to us to compete with our memories of trauma. You wouldn't sort of use that every time you do a communion service, but every once in a while it might be a sort of a theme that sort of shapes how we as a congregation think about this. There's also the theme of companionship in suffering. We come to remember the sufferings of Jesus. And one of the things we learn here at this table is that suffering is something that God is familiar with, and he can come along beside us and be with us in the midst of that. There's also the theme of communion as a kind of spiritual nurture. God feeds us with spiritual food. And I think there's enormous potential in that theme for people who have struggled with abuse, particularly for people who are struggling with spiritual abuse, that God is not the one who shames you, who blames you, who judges you. God is the one who comes to nurture you. That worship is not so much our coming to give God things, but our coming to the table so God can give to us. It is God who feeds his people. That's what communion is. And so come today. God has something for you. Communion as the kind of solidarity and resistance to evil that was going on in the death of Jesus is God willing to fight to the bitter end against the forces of evil and doing whatever it takes. And God is with that. If we are in the struggle against evil, God joins us in that. Finally, there's a theme. I don't have time to play this out. Those of you who some of you may recognize this as a reflection of Girardian metaphysics, but that's a whole other topic. The communion as a celebration of the end of sacrifice, that any sacrifice that needed to be done was accomplished by Jesus on the cross. That no more sacrifices are necessary. No more scapegoats are necessary. No more blaming other people is necessary. All of the blame and shame that ever needed to be borne has been borne by Jesus. We don't need to do that anymore. We can move on. A little more complicated theme, but in some contexts, I think there's some wonderful insights that can be teased out of that. Same kind of thought could go into baptism. And how you shape, here I'm asking you to think about how you would shape doing baptism as a way of helping people who had been abused in various ways. Now, that question is more important than any of my answers to it. How would you use sort of one of the major events of the local congregation in ways to help people who have been abused? Ask yourself that question, not just about communion and baptism, but about all the sort of structural sort of events that are structured into the life of the church. But baptism, just a few ideas. It's about death and rebirth. That's sure what recovery feels like. It feels like you're dying, and it's painful, and there's all these losses that you're experiencing. But sometimes when you find yourself at the point of having lost so much and there's nothing left to lose, you find that God has not given up on birthing us. and gives new life. Baptism as a transition into a spiritual family that is often in tension with our biological families. What is God's family like? I think I talked about this earlier, didn't I? In God's family, the father feels very comfortable publicly saying, I love this kid. He really makes me happy. And if you didn't come from a family like that, this may be a little disorienting for you. But here in God's family, that's the kind of stuff we say all the time. God loves you like crazy and takes delight in you. That's what God's family's like. We want to welcome you to God's family. And we hope that you can learn here some of the things that you can only learn when you receive that kind of blessing from the Father. You can also talk about baptism as a rite of passage. I think it has that element to it, not just sort of the familial sort of becoming part of God's family theme, but it's also a spiritual rite of passage, a kind of a growth, a commitment to a growth process. Perhaps, again, theologies of baptism differ widely among people who are going to be watching this lecture, so I don't want to imply any particular theological frame here. But sometimes that sort of notion of passage can be really helpful to people struggling with abuse, because they have this sense of being in motion, needing to move to a different place in life. And this being a marker for significant life transformation, it has a lot of potential to it. There's also the sense in which baptism represents a commitment to a lifelong journey. We're baptized not to signify something's finished, but that something's beginning, that things don't have to be in the future the way they have been in the past. We're baptized into a new lifelong process of a living life in relationship to God, who nurtures us and longs for the best for us and loves us like crazy and just takes delight in us. That sort of marking that transition is a potential theme that you could use for baptism. And finally, just the notion of baptism as a cleansing ritual is something that I think has potential for people who have abused, often feeling dirtied by. It's sort of a very concrete representation of shame, being dirty. And here in this ritual, we recognize what is true for all of us every day, that when we come into the presence of God, we can be cleansed. That everything that needs to be done for us to be clean, God has taken care of. And God is the one who cleans us. Because some of this stuff you scrub a lot on, and it doesn't go away just because you scrub harder. It really needs the intervention of God and the power of God and the love of God to transform us. But that's what we are here today to affirm, to celebrate. That no matter how much cleaning needs to be done, God knows how to get it done. And we can rely on, depend on, lean into, express gratitude for God's commitment to that. Again, in different traditions, these different themes will shape themselves out in different ways. But I just wanted to encourage you to be thinking about how to take sort of normal pastoral practices and shape them in ways that would be particularly helpful to people who are recovering from abuse or trauma. Okay, I just got a bunch more stuff and I'm feeling frustrated at the end here, but that's part of the deal. It's almost an hour. We're cutting down. Maybe I'll talk about some other stuff in the forum. We'll see how things go. Thanks for showing up. I'll see you in the forums. Bye-bye.